You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been more than a month since Wisconsin started reopening, and now the U.S. is officially in a recession. We'll check in on how small businesses are doing at this stage of the pandemic. First, at the end of May, Wisconsin's emergency ban on most evictions and foreclosures expired. The ban was aimed to help protect our tenants and homeowners who may have lost jobs or income because of the coronavirus pandemic. Groups who defend tenants' rights as well as homeless shelters have been worried about a potential rush of eviction filings and service needs. So without the ban, have those worries come true? The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reviewed court records and reported a 42% increase in eviction filings around Wisconsin during the first 2 weeks of June over 2019. In Milwaukee, the number was slightly higher, they reported. Chris Mokler is Director of Legislative Affairs for the Wisconsin Apartment Association. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Rafael Ramos is an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin, where he directs the Eviction Defense Project. Rafael, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Rafael, let's start with you. In these first weeks since this eviction ban ended, what have we seen? How bad have things been?
You know, we've been hearing a lot of inquiries from concerned tenants who've either already had an eviction case filed against them or have received a notice terminating their tenancy, so a five-day notice saying that they're going to have to pay or move out, which is basically the precursor to an eviction. So we've been hearing from a lot of concerned folks that they are at risk of losing their housing because the eviction bans have come to an end and because the coronavirus has, you know, thrown a lot of people's lives into disarray.
That's on the tenant side. Chris, what are you hearing from apartment association members about tenants' ability to pay and whether they're considering evictions?
Well, of course, landlords are concerned because this is the money that pays their mortgage, pays the repairs, pays for the taxes, the real estate taxes, and about what's left is about 9 cents or less for a smaller owner that actually goes into their pocket, pays for their groceries, and pays for their mortgages on their own house, et cetera, et cetera. So they have concerns because filing an eviction doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get paid. They want a way to, you know, get paid from the tenant that hasn't paid them. Some of those tenants are waiting for unemployment. Some of those tenants are waiting for wrap funds. And some of those tenants, besides for the tenants that have paid, some of those tenants aren't always doing anything, and they have a concern about that, leaving eviction to be their only last-moment choice. The Wisconsin Apartment Association has been telling our landlords members across Wisconsin to try to work with their tenants and try to do something to resolve the issue and make evictions the last resort, help them with their wrap application. You know, get them the information. It's not their responsibility, but whatever you can do to help, we're in a community problem. Let's try to work as a community to solve it.
And Rafael, for people worried about eviction, for people who are at the stage even where they know they're going to have trouble making their rent, what kind of resources might be out there, especially in this time of coronavirus, that might help them make ends meet?
Certainly. Well, I think Chris has mentioned a few already, and at that said, I want to thank Chris and the others, you know, from their side of the aisle who are trying to encourage people to work things out, because the way things are, communication and patience is kind of a key here, because it sometimes takes time to access these resources, right? So, you know, Chris mentioned the wrap funding. I think it's important for people throughout the state to look at their local service providers. For example, in Milwaukee County, the county has just announced that they're going to make almost $6-7 million available through the Rental Housing Resource Center and Community Advocates, where people can get up to $3,000 to help pay back rent, which obviously helps tenants, but by extension helps the landlords who have to pay their mortgage. So I think right now it's really critical for people to look to see what resources are available, both at a federal and also local level, to make sure that they're trying to avail themselves of these funds that previously didn't exist. So there are some new resources out there that people should really be looking to access.
And Chris, for that landlord, especially the smaller one who may not have a lot of cash reserves built up, is there a backstop for them? Is there help for them if their source of revenue has dried up as their tenants are unable to pay?
No, not really. We've all heard about that PPP, Paycheck Protection Plan, and we've heard about the economic injury and disaster loans. Those don't always apply to some of the smaller landlords because they're considered a passive investment and are treated differently under the tax law and have not been eligible in many cases. Now, I've heard of some cases where some landlords are getting them, and I've heard of many cases where they're not. So, collecting the rent is the only real way. There might be a few programs around that individual cities have offered. I don't know how many landlords will qualify because the information is just coming out, and the devil's always in the details. So there's not really a big program out there to individually help landlords. They really just want to get their rent paid and keep doing business as usual.
We're talking about evictions and the difficulty some people are having paying their rent and the difficulty landlords are having in this tough economic time. Chris Mokler is with us with the Wisconsin Apartment Association, Rafael Ramos from Legal Action of Wisconsin. Rafael, Chris had mentioned from the landlord side the idea of, hey, if you have somebody who has trouble paying rent, reach out to them, talk. What advice do you have for that tenant when they're realizing they might have trouble paying when it comes to talking to their landlords?
Yeah, I think communication is really one of the most critical parts of all this. In fact, communication breakdowns, even pre-COVID-19, were one of the main reasons that we saw a lot of people end up running into issues with their landlords. So just initiating that conversation, trying to be forthright and upfront about the fact that you may not be able to pay now, but you're actively working to obtain resources to help you pay. And frankly, having the landlord's assistance in completing some of that paperwork, showing that there is a threat of eviction coming, is oftentimes a prerequisite to accessing some of these funds. You know, whether that's some fund sources requiring a 5-day notice or some other confirmation that they are behind in rent. You know, the conversation between the two parties is really critical because, you know, I'm a lawyer. I defend tenants who are behind in rent, but if it truly is just a non-payment issue, there's no protection afforded to tenants, beyond what they would normally be able to argue as part of their legal case that's specific to COVID-19 with a handful of limited exceptions. So people really need to try to figure out some sort of accommodation that works well for everybody.
And Chris, what I think I'm hearing from both of you is, whatever side of the equation you're on, don't assume that the landlord-tenant relationship is an adversarial one at the outset.
We really want to see people try to break down that, which I'm sure Raphael will agree, the past existence of that tough relationship. Now is the time to try to break that down. Every Friday we have a Wisconsin Apartment Association COVID-19 Task Force update. Long name, but basically we're telling our members, giving them the latest and the greatest information on what's going on, and reminding them that now is the time to get to know your tenant. And we start right from the start. We said back in March, if you have an older tenant, reach out and see if they need anything. Get them some groceries, whatever. I mean, I just had a landlord the other day, last week, Thursday, tell me that he had a tenant that had COVID-19, and he says, I will go get your groceries. I'll put them by your back door. You can pay me later. Do what you can do to help it out. If you have a younger tenant, they may be confused on what to do. Help them out. You're probably an older guy or an older gal, and you can help them out. Answer their questions. Now is the time to try to work together. Ask them how they're doing. And while you're learning from them, you'll know if they're going to be able to pay their rent or not. And then come up with a solution and try to figure it out. Because really, an eviction serves nobody's purpose. I mean, unless you've got a tenant that simply is not going to pay or cannot pay, you need to remove them to get a tenant in, hopefully that does pay, because you've got bills to pay. But that's really got to be a last resort in my mind.
I want to wrap up by asking each of you, and let's start with you, Raphael. Are there more fixes you'd like to see either from state government or federal government to help tenants weather the current crisis?
Sure. So unfortunately, because our compliance obligations is a federally funded program, I can't advocate for particular changes of that nature. But I will kind of echo some of the sentiments that Chris shared, which is that the communication, the working together between parties is important. Because when you look at eviction, Chris mentioned this a while back, it's not really a surefire way for landlords to get the money that's owed. It's just looking to remove a person who lives there. So if the person who is been renting from a property has been a good tenant and is now fallen on hard times, really it's really in the the best interest of everyone to work something out so that you can maintain that relationship long term. And let's also not remember the specter of the pandemic behind all of this, because eviction out of necessity increases movement among the population, creating greater health risk for everybody. So there are really a lot of reasons why it's in individual interest and communal interest to try to navigate these waters together.
And Chris, in our last few moments, a change you might like to see either legislatively or in our renting culture.
Well, I just hope that people keep working together, and we're going to have to Monday morning quarterback and see how this all worked out. The Wisconsin Apartment Association, along with Legal Aid and Community Advocates, Public Policy Institute, asked the governor for four different things, working on homeless and working on corrections and inmates that are going to be released, and financial assistance for landlords via paying rent, you know, for tenants that need it. And the governor came back and more than doubled what we asked for. So we're happy about that. It's how far that's going to go and how many people it's going to help is yet to be seen. It might break down to $28 per rental unit, but not all those people need help. So it's kind of really going to have to see what happens and go from there. I really don't think an eviction moratorium extension helps. I just think that we need people to work together because this is a community problem and try to solve it as a community.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Rafael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We've been talking to Chris Mokler, Director of Legislative Affairs for the Wisconsin Apartment Association, and Rafael Ramos, Director of the Eviction Defense Project at Legal Action of Wisconsin, looking at rentals and evictions around the state. Coming up, we'll check in with the Small Business Administration's Wisconsin office about how the state's small businesses are doing and the federal programs available to help them out. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump says he's open to more police reform measures from Congress after his own executive order yesterday. We'll find out what lawmakers are proposing and what's likely to pass. First, the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic has been massive in the U.S. Last month's unemployment rate was close to 15%, second only to levels seen in the Great Depression. Those numbers have gotten a little better lately, but businesses around the country continue to deal with the financial toll of the outbreak. And small businesses in particular can be some of the most financially fragile. Eric Ness is the District Director for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Wisconsin District with locations in Madison and Milwaukee. He's participating in a discussion about how COVID-19 is impacting small businesses this Friday with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, I assume we're going to be sorting out data for months and even years, but where we are now, Eric, what are we seeing when it comes to the impact on Wisconsin's small businesses?
Well, as everyone knows, people's business plans changed. Your break-even changed, and we're taking a look at a lot of the different industries and how those businesses are changing and coping with the new realities that are out there. We've seen some businesses that have done well. I was just at a bike shop yesterday, and they can't keep bikes in their store. They're going out really fast. But we also know the hospitality businesses with their break-even analysis on how many people need to come through their doors or they need to serve is a really challenging area right now. And so that's kind of the role we're trying to play, is help those small businesses with our staff and our partners to say, you know, how can you be successful in this market?
We're going to be talking more closely about restaurants on the show tomorrow. But restaurants, we know, were pretty hard hit. And as you say, if they can open but not with full capacity, that's not necessarily a recipe for success. What are you telling restaurant owners in particular about how they can hopefully get through this all?
Well, specifically, I mean, they're going to be looking at their break-evens and how that all works with their business. And naturally, they're having to modify their business plans. We have our small business development centers and our women's business centers and our SCORE chapters and our VBOX who are there to work with people as they kind of modify their plans. But one of the things that we've heard that has been somewhat successful, I just talked to a restaurant owner earlier this week, and he utilized a couple of our SBA programs to, number one, pay his staff and pay part of the rent and utilities and payroll, but they also used a couple of our programs, and I'm specifically talking of the Payroll Protection Program, which helped pay staff. And now we've actually kind of eased up some of the forgiveness guidelines to help those small businesses be able to get those loans forgiven.
If there's a small business owner listening and heard you list off, you know, four or five different resources just now and is thinking, wait, what? How do they reach out and get the kind of help that your group has to offer?
Excellent. Well, just so far in Wisconsin, 81,000 Wisconsin businesses and nonprofits have gotten over $9.8 billion to help them with their payroll and for paying their interest on mortgages, rents, and utilities. That program has worked well, and you can go through your local lender to get information. You can always go on SBA.gov/Wisconsin to get local resources. It's been a great program for paying payroll. But we also have something, and what I want to mention on that program ends on June 30th. So if you're interested in that program, get with your local lenders or get on our website or find a lender they want to work with to utilize that program. It's a forgivable loan as long as 60% of the amount goes to payroll. So that's a great program. We also, I think yesterday, we opened up the Economic Injury Disaster Loan for Wisconsin. We actually reopened it up. And basically, so far in Wisconsin, we've worked with 15,000 small businesses and nonprofits for $960 million. And we have a grant side of that called the Economic Injury Disaster Advance, where we pay up to $1,000 per employee as an advance grant, up to $10,000. And we've done 43,511 of those loans for $10.3 billion. That just opened up. So go on the SBA.gov website, and you'd be able to apply right now. So that's two great programs that are out there. SBA is known for our SBA loans, our 7A, our 504, and our microloans, which basically we can do loans, $1,000 up to $50,000 and up to $5 million with our 7A and up to $5.5 million with our 504. We're actually, if you get one of those loans before the end of September 27th, and get it closed, we're going to make 6 months of your payments for the next 6 months. And we've done that actually with the past SBA loans that have been on the books. So that's a great program to take a look at if you're needing financing needs, working capital needs, and maybe EIDL or Paycheck Protection isn't working for you. You also have access to the regular SBA loan programs with the debt relief being out there for the next 6 months.
Talking to Eric Ness from the U.S. Small Business Administration's Wisconsin District, looking at help available for small businesses in the state. Eric, some people might be listening thinking, hey, maybe my business is too small for any of this to matter to me or for me to matter to them. If I have a salon and two part-time employees or I'm a catering contractor, it's just me. Is it going to be worth the bother of getting to the Small Business Administration applying for this stuff?
Well, from the EIDL perspective, we do the grants for, say you had two or three employees, you would get $1,000 per employee and yourself. So that would be $3,000 if you had three employees. We can do loans, and I've seen even our payroll protection program loans go down to $1,000. So if that makes your business plan work, take a look at it and utilize it. And right now, with the forgiveness side of the payroll protection through the end of June, take a look at it and see if it makes sense for you. But and then, of course, our SBA micro loans, our loans under $50,000, getting one for $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, and then we make those payments for the next 6 months is not a bad addition to your business plan.
And Eric, we've been focusing on the money side of things. You mentioned the SCORE program. Can you talk about that as a service for people to have, an experienced business person to help them figure things out?
Well, I think that's really one of the great things that SBA does, and we have our resource partners. So SCORE is a business person that's either in business or has been in business who can sit down and work with you when you're running into some of these crazy and challenging challenges right now, that they can kind of talk you through, and you can have somebody to run some of your thoughts by and get some feedback. And it's free, a great opportunity to have and get a little advice and run a couple scenarios by a business or by somebody else besides you.
Are people taking advantage of these various services we've been talking about, or do you think more people should be giving you a call right about now?
Well, I think that a lot of businesses are starting to or are working with some of the challenges, of course, we've had with some of our business owners is just getting them enough information so some of the loan programs can make those decisions. And our small business development centers, our women's business centers have been there, and our SCORE chapters have been there to kind of give you advice. Number one, encouragement. Number two, little direction on how to be able to access some of these programs and make changes to your business plan.
And as we wrap up, Eric, what's the best way for people to reach out and find out more about the programs we've been talking about?
Go to sba.gov/WI, and you'll come right to our website. There'll actually be a Corona area where you can just click on, and you'll get you right to these programs.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Eric Ness, District Director for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Wisconsin District. He was with us today to talk about how the COVID-19 outbreak has impacted small businesses and services available for those business owners. If you want to hear more on the state of small business in Wisconsin, Eric will be talking about this on Friday in a Facebook Live event with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. You can find details about that at our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, we'll catch up on the week in Washington, including police reform bills in both chambers of Congress and an executive order on that issue as well from the president. We'll try to sort out who's doing what and what they may be able to compromise on. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump signed an executive order yesterday encouraging police departments to undergo new training on the use of force. We'll take a closer look with a Wisconsin expert on criminal justice. First, we take our look at the week in Washington. The White House is trying to block the release of a book by former National Security Advisor John Bolton. A show of force by North Korea this week sets back relations with the U.S. and South Korea. And after the president's executive order yesterday, Senate Republicans still plan to vote on their own police reform package. House Democrats passed their own version last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the different police reform ideas put forth by the president, Republicans, and Democrats? Should things like a chokehold ban be required or just encouraged? Do you think the president's order yesterday was a step in the right direction? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James Homan is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the daily 202 newsletter. James, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, before we get to some of those breaking news stories, James, I want to talk to you about a piece out today. It's the fifth anniversary of the racist shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. You talked to Anthony Thompson, the husband of one of the victims of that shooting, Myra Quarles Singleton Thompson. Can you share some of that story with us?
Yeah, it really is a sad anniversary. It's been 5 years now. Dylan Roof, a white supremacist, went into a Bible study where nine African Americans on a Wednesday night at a historically black church, beautiful church, were praying at the end of their Bible study. He killed them all, and he's been totally unrepentant. He said he would do it again. He's on death row right now. And, you know, we have these mass shootings and then, you know, our attention understandably moves on. But for these families, they haven't moved on. But what listeners probably remember is that right after this shooting, 2 days later during a bond hearing, several of the relatives of the people who were murdered at this Bible study stood up and said that they forgave the shooter, kind of in the Christian tradition of forgiveness. And, you know, Dylan Roof, the shooter, has been unrepentant, but Anthony Thompson, who himself is a reverend, he was one of the people that day. He said kind of the words just came to him. And so he has spent the last couple of years trying to work on racial reconciliation. And so it was really interesting to talk to him just because, you know, one of the things that he says is this white supremacist who killed his wife, he wrote in an online screed that he hoped to trigger a race war and that he hoped to divide the races by doing this. And so what Mr. Thompson says is my mission is to make sure that he doesn't succeed. And so he's doing all he can to try and bring whites and African-Americans together in Charleston and South Carolina and around the country. And so really an inspiring story of someone who, you know, has just shown so much grace under such an extraordinary tragedy that for, you know, most of us is just unimaginable to have that happen to a spouse.
It's a powerful story. People can see that at the Washington Post website today. Moving on to the big political news of the week, James, President Trump signed this executive order on policing. What were the key elements that the White House included in the order?
It's a lot of guidelines. It's a lot of suggestions. It's encouraging local departments to follow best practices, to encourage more use of body cameras, but not anything really kind of required, and gives a lot of discretion to Attorney General Bill Barr. Notably, you know, the president surrounded himself as he signed the executive order with members of law enforcement, representatives of powerful police unions. So, you know, the Democrats on the Hill said it didn't go far enough. A lot of the activist groups, kind of the Black Lives Matter community, said it was just show, you know, just for show and doesn't really accomplish anything meaningful. On Capitol Hill today, Senate Republicans unveiled their big plan that they've been trying to negotiate, have Republican support for. They're going to need some Democratic support for it to be able to pass the Senate. Meanwhile, in the House today, Democrats had a committee hearing to mark up their proposal. So far, the House Democrats and Senate Republicans are kind of far apart. But one of the things that's been striking in my reporting today up on Capitol Hill is that there is a desire among Senate Republicans who are worried about losing their majority in November to get something done, to kind of put points on the board. And so there's right now the two sides are pretty far apart substantively, but in the last few hours, I've seen some appetite on the right. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, appeared at the press conference to unveil the draft bill today to at least kind of show that there's a real push to actually get this across the finish line.
Want to give a listen to the president speaking yesterday. He said he had met with families of victims of police killings. As you mentioned, he was joined at the signing ceremony by law enforcement officials. Here's a short listen.
What's needed now is not more stoking of fear and division. We need to bring law enforcement and communities closer together, not to drive them apart. Under the executive order I'm signing today, we will prioritize federal grants from the Department of Justice to police departments that seek independent credentialing, certifying that they meet high standards.
So the president's going with more carrot than stick here, it sounds like. Yeah. They'll give grants to departments that voluntarily do these things.
Exactly. And that's the key thing, is that, you know, when you talk to the activists who are out in the streets and the protesters, you know, we've now had like 17 straight nights of protests here in D.C. You know, they say that there are these systemic problems that have to be addressed. And this does not kind of look for systemic changes. It looks for changes, you know, in encouraging people with carrots, as you say, that's absolutely right. But it's not, there's no overhaul of kind of approach to law enforcement by any means.
Talking to James Holman from The Washington Post, looking at the big news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see coming from the president, from Congress, when it comes to police reform? If anything, do you think it should be up to state and local governments to deal with these issues? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's dig into what you mentioned, James, about Congress. What are the high points of what we're seeing so far from Senate Republicans?
Well, Senate Republicans are, you know, they really are looking to codify, you know, it's similar to the president's plan, but it goes a little bit further. You know, the bill does not include a ban on chokeholds, even though there's a lot of support for that in a bipartisan way. The big hang up between the Senate plan and the House plan is getting rid of qualified immunity for police. The Supreme Court said on Monday that they're not going to take that issue up. A lot of House Democrats say it's their top priority, which is to make it easier for people who are abused, where an officer violates their civil rights, violates the law, to be able to take them or the department or the city to court. Democrats say that is a must-have. Republicans say it's a non-starter, and it is not in their legislation.
Talk a little more about the Democratic side of things. They're asserting more control, it seems like, over local police departments, or their bill would do that more than what we're seeing from Senate Republicans or the president. Is that about right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a 175-page draft piece of legislation that really would impose a lot more federal control over local police and dictating what they can and can't do. That's absolutely correct.
You mentioned that there is some appetite for compromise, but it seems like some things are deal breakers for one side or another. Just based on what you're hearing so far, what specific parts of the proposals do you see both sides maybe heading toward agreement on?
I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up getting a consensus on chokehold ban, on some community policing, on some, you know, we'll definitely have kind of some commissions and stuff like that, but that's not what people are really looking for. You could see some reforms on the militarization of police departments. There are a lot of conservatives who, you know, think that the police departments shouldn't be getting weapons of war from the Pentagon and surplus. Tens of billions of dollars have gone out to local police departments, you know, including like rocket launchers and we've seen a lot of these mine resistant anti-tank vehicles that are driving around in the streets. And so I think that there's some appetite on both sides to maybe scale that program a little bit back, and just generally trying to, there's a lot of emphasis that both sides can agree on related to training, improving the quality of training and the training requirements for officers at the get-go. And also there's some conversation where I think you could see movement between the two sides on kind of accountability for all the officers involved. One of the issues in the Minneapolis incident was that there were these three officers who were sort of standing there watching what was happening. And one of the questions the courts are going to have to take up and juries will take up is how liable are those officers for not intervening? And so there's some discussion about adding kind of a duty to intervene into the federal statute. We'll see if that happens. That might be a more of a stretch.
We're talking to James Holman, national political correspondent at The Washington Post, looking at some of the week's biggest stories in national politics, including various police reform measures in the works. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there one element, one thing you would definitely like to change coming from Congress or the president when it comes to police reform? Or is there something you really oppose from what you just heard about, what's on the table there? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with James Holman, political correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the Daily 202 newsletter, looking at some of the big stories in national politics this week. James, before we move on from issues of police reform, let's go to a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to ask you, Jeff, what would the role of public unions are in this in these tragedies. I mean, the real question would be if the union is protecting police that probably shouldn't be on the force, and so many of the police are really trying so hard and doing a great job. Isn't it the unions that we need to take a look at? And that might even go for teachers. I mean, if the unions are protecting people who aren't doing a good job teaching, maybe it's time for us to reexamine public unions with people who don't have the chance to really be scrutinized in how they're doing their job.
Charlie, thanks for the call. James, I think I had seen in the news at least some Republicans in Congress have brought up the issue of union protections for police.
Well, it's interesting because this creates odd bedfellows and unique coalitions, because the police unions are incredibly powerful and they have negotiated into their bargaining agreements with cities that various protections, making it harder to get rid of cops who officers who have gotten in trouble or gotten, did basically limit discipline and create appeals processes, et cetera. You know, liberals, Democrats obviously tend to be very pro-union, and a lot of the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, defending police unions, but a lot of progressive leaders in Congress feel like police unions are this big obstacle to reform. And so there's some tension between the labor movement and kind of the Black Lives Matter movement within the Democratic Party over how much, to restrict union power. And, there's some Democrats on the Hill I've talked to who would love to say in federal law that certain things are not on the table in collective bargaining negotiations between cities and police unions related to officer discipline. And but the Republicans, this is a weird one, because Republicans are in some cases in Congress right now defending the power of the police unions, at the same time that generally they're not favorable to unions. It's creating tension for someone like Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential candidate, who has spent decades very close, very connected with police unions. They've endorsed him in all of his past campaigns. They endorsed the Obama-Biden reelection in 2012. But the police unions are angry at Biden because they say that he's not taken their side in the last few weeks. And then they view him as antagonistic. And it's kind of striking to go back and watch some videos from not that many years ago where Biden says basically that he let the police unions write his 1994 crime bill, and he invited them into his office and treated them as if they were his own staff in drafting the legislation. And so there's definitely kind of some tension within the Democratic Party on this one.
Let's take one more caller before we move on to all the other stuff going on in the nation's capital. Virginia is with us in Milwaukee. Virginia, hi. Virginia, are you there? Looks like she's not, but she wanted to bring up issues of police training. Are there any moves in Congress when it comes to bigger, better standards, growing standards for police training, James?
Yeah, there's definitely a desire to create some sort of national framework. Now, the question is, how specific should that framework be? What kind of requirements should there be? We obviously live in a federalist society, and there's a big desire to leave a lot of this up to states and local governments, and I think that there could be some kind of national training framework that grows out of this.
We're talking to James Homan from the Washington Post, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Let's touch on a couple more. John Bolton, former national security advisor, longtime foreign policy hawk, now has this book probably coming out soon, a lawsuit from the Trump administration against him, not the publisher. And now things coming out. The book is in the hands of many media outlets. I don't even know where to start on this one, James. Where do you want to start?
Well, I have my leaked copy sitting on my desk right here, and starting to work through it. So I think that they're not going to be able to put this genie back in the bottle. we've obtained it and reported. There's a lot. There's a lot of material. It's a meaty book, and Bolton is no love lost for pretty much anyone in the White House. The president certainly is not spared, but neither are a lot of others. The Attorney General Bill Barr takes a lot of criticism. Bolton details a lot of negative comments that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, privately made to him, allegedly, about the president's intellect and intelligence. One of the big takeaways, just based on my reading so far, I'm still really pouring through this book, is Trump's, you know, again, a lot of this, if you're following the news and foreign policy closely, not surprising, but Trump's affinity for authoritarians is really striking. Just his some of the most newsworthy material in the book is about Trump's private meetings with Xi Jinping, the leader of China. According to Bolton, at one point, Trump said, "I need your help getting reelected." He said that he didn't mind the Chinese having camps for the Uyghurs, the Muslim minority. He said that, he has made positive and favorable comments about, Xi extending his term so that he can be president for life. Xi apparently told Trump, "You have too many elections in the United States." And Trump said, "You're right. I wish I could serve more than two terms, and I wish I didn't have to run for re-election every 4 years." And Bolton saying that Trump did not appear to be joking during these conversations. And similarly, the president has had these kinds of conversations with, essentially dictators, from Kim Jong-un in North Korea to, al-Sisi in Egypt and Vladimir Putin in Russia and so forth. And, Bolton's a longtime national security hawk. He had top jobs in the last three Republican White Houses, including Reagan's. And he, Trump brought him into the fold. The Justice Department suggesting this afternoon, leaking out to reporters, that they're looking at criminal charges against Bolton for publishing this information. But it's hard to see any court upholding that kind of thing. And Bolton also saying that one of the striking things so far, as I've been reading through the book, is that Trump probably deserved impeachment for more than just the Ukraine imbroglio, that it was malpractice for Democrats to only impeach on Ukraine, he says, and that there were a whole lot of other things on foreign policy Trump did that could have been impeachable.
Well, one related story that you have followed over the last week has to do with North Korea and its nuclear program. The president had, this televised, highly publicized meeting with Kim Jong-un. Looked like prospects were there for negotiations and agreements. What's happened over this last week, though?
Yeah, so Bolton was there. Bolton writes about these three North Korean summits, essentially, that have been held. So we've been distracted. It's not just the last week. We've obviously, understandably, been paying attention to the coronavirus and the protests and the economy. But over the last several weeks, North Korea has been escalating tensions, kind of speaking a lot more negatively about the United States. And on Monday morning, Tuesday morning, they blew up this liaison office that they had opened in 2018. And there's no, because technically North and South Korea are still at war. They just have an armistice that ended the Korean War. This essentially has been functioning as sort of an embassy, and it's in the demilitarized zone. North Korea literally blew it up. And it's a metaphor for kind of blowing up the relationship. You know, the North Koreans have done this before. They when they want something, when they want concessions, they tend to lash out and, act petulant. And it appears that they're doing that now. The maximum pressure campaign of sanctions has been working in the goal of kind of really shutting down the regime and its access to the outside world. But this is something, we're such a long way from that Singapore summit. That was only 2 years ago last week. And Trump declared that the North Koreans had agreed to give up all their nuclear weapons. They hadn't actually agreed to do that, but that's what the president said. And, 2 years later, the North Koreans actually have expanded their nuclear capacity. They haven't given up a single warhead, and they have, resumed missile testing last year. So it's not getting enough attention, but the North Korea threat remains quite real. And, they're still working behind the scenes to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles that are capable of hitting the West Coast.
Briefly, James, in our last 30 seconds or so, so much going on. What do you have your eye on next?
The coronavirus, we haven't really talked about much, but it is just so significant. And, with the numbers, I'm watching the numbers every day. President Trump is going ahead with his rally in Tulsa on Saturday. The indoor rally, the Republican mayor isn't going to stop it, but also says he's uncomfortable with it and isn't going to go, isn't going to let anyone in his family go. Oklahoma is reporting record numbers of increases in cases. So that's sort of what I have my eye on now.
James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
We've been talking to James Holman, national political correspondent at The Washington Post, author there of the Daily 202 newsletter. He joined us for our look at the week's news from the nation's capital, including police reform measures from the White House and Congress. In just a few minutes, actually, we're going to dig more deeply into some of those police reform proposals, especially the one from the president. You may have heard on this show and elsewhere that WPR is doing a virtual 5K run this week with a Beethoven's Fifth theme. And one of our WPR colleagues took the idea really literally. Kay Drew is on our Madison Business Sponsorship team. Kay, hi.
Hi, Rob.
Now, you did something special and unique with Beethoven's Fifth through your run. Tell us what you did.
I mapped out how to run the first four notes of the symphony so that it would show up on my Strava in note form.
Yeah, so this is one of those things, I don't run, so I don't do this, but you can kind of map out what you've run and then have it show up as an image. So you actually plot out a course to do the musical notes?
Yes, yes.
And how hard was it to do that, to get it right and then get the notes right too?
Well, the getting the notes wasn't so hard. It was getting it to end at exactly a 5K. So it's pretty easy to map out four notes, but to make them be the right distance was the interesting challenge of it.
Was that extra extra inspiration in our last few moments for your exercise?
Find any excuse, and making pretty pictures is certainly a good one.
That's Kay Drew, Madison Business Sponsorship Team, celebrating Beethoven with a run.